This episode of We Are Libertarians is brought to you by Audible.com. Enjoy one free audiobook courtesy of We Are Libertarians. Choose from more than 100,000 audiobook titles, including works by Ron Paul, Walter Block, Murray Rothbard, and the Cato Institute. Audible.com also has audio of radio and TV programs and audio versions of magazines and newspapers. You can get the Audible app on any mobile device or download the audio to your computer. Go to audibletrial.com/WAL or head to WeAreLibertarians.com and find the link to get one free month of Audible today. Welcome to We Are Libertarians for this week. I am your somewhat faithful host, Chris Spangle. To my left is the always faithful Greg Lenz.
Chris, how are you? Great to have you back.
I'm doing well. Hey, you over there, look at this guy. He's bald. He's Brett. Brett Bittner, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys and my first
insult.
We Are Libertarians podcast.
I know. Frequent listener of the program, right?
Of course. I've listened to every single episode.
He's already lying.
Have you ever heard one?
Not a single one.
This is my great friend. See the kind of friends that I have.
Doesn't he like work in like some sort of liberty movement or something like that?
Yeah. Okay, so here's how I know Brett Bittner. Brett Bittner is the former executive director of the Libertarian Party of Georgia. He was highly successful there because he just ripped off all the ideas I had as the executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana.
That's true, but great, I made them all better.
Student. That's right.
I made all of them better.
Because while I am an idea man, I am not an execution man. As subscribers to this podcast lately have seen. And we'll address that soon here in a minute.
Did something drop? It sounded like a metal gold thing that just fell off.
Oh, crank call. Mr. Brett Bittner, you are now in Indiana. You have left the Libertarian Party of Georgia.
Yep, a month ago. Yep.
Right. And how do you feel?
Pretty great.
Yeah.
Nothing against folks in the Libertarian Party or the Libertarian Party of Georgia, but it's a pretty awesome change and definitely for the good.
So what are you doing now?
I'm working with the Advocates for Self-Government and their quiz engagement program. If you've ever seen the World's Smallest Political Quiz, it's a 10-question quiz that's mashed up with the Nolan chart, where it kind of gives you an idea of where you fall on the political map outside of just a left-right, one-dimensional look at politics. It's a 2D diamond that really gives you a better grasp of where you fall on the political spectrum.
Right. And you are working at the Engelhardt Group.
Yes.
You are currently using a computer that a great man once used.
Well, I don't know that I would say that he was great because I'm still having trouble getting updates because I haven't figured out how Macs work.
He is sitting in a chair that a great man once sat in.
Yeah, but I had to switch chairs because wasn't working out for
you
me.
You did what?
I switched the chairs.
The chair in that office was magnificent. Why would you get rid of that chair?
It was too low. There was no bounce. And
there was.
It
had great lumbar support, and that's what you need in a good solid chair. And it was leather.
Yeah.
I wiped it down with leather wipes to make sure that it was properly cared for. I miss that chair. If you're not going to use it, send it my way.
Well, I'm a little worried about how much you love that chair.
Well, you should be if you're sitting in it. All right. So Brett Bittner moved up to Indiana and has taken my former job, mine, meaning possessive. So don't mess it up or I will hurt you.
Except like everything that I've taken from Chris Spangle, I will do it better.
That's right, which is why you were my... it's one of the reasons I helped recommend you for the job, along with a couple other good candidates. But I'm really happy for you. Glad that you get to do it. And as a person who was the former state executive director full-time, who transitioned into that job, you're going to love it.
Oh, I already do. We're 3 weeks in, and I love actually being done in the afternoon or evening and not having a candidate emergency or an affiliate emergency.
Or hearing what you do wrong all of the time.
Right, because you never do anything right. You're only doing the wrong things, yes.
If we just explained HOPPA to people more succinctly, we would have more libertarians.
Oh, boy. Yeah. It really is an interesting change as you go from party politics into a job that is more think tanky. You know, the majority of what I assume you'll be doing, because obviously you'll be doing maybe something different, who knows, than what I did. I don't ask. I don't like to know about, you know, my former jobs and their current lovers. It hurts too much. don't even, Greg. And the... but you get to think about the ideas of libertarianism a lot more. You get to think about how that's being messaged, how that can be communicated to libertarians and non-libertarians. So it's really an interesting change. What are some of the differences that you've seen between just in your month or as you've been thinking about the job? Like, what are some of the differences between party politics within the Libertarian Party and being in a think tanky type role? Because it's not really a think tank, but it's sort of like that.
Well, I think I have a lot more freedom in terms of what I can say and how I can share things, as we'll even discuss later in the issues that we have to talk about tonight. There's a point where when you're the face of a group or an organization or a movement where you're always afraid that you're going to tarnish their reputation, or you're going to say something out of turn, or you're going to say something that doesn't quite fit with what everybody within that organization feels.
Right.
You know, when you're representing hundreds of members or thousands of members across the country, because for many people you are the only representative of the Libertarian Party that people right. know, you're always very apprehensive and questioning every move you make, which, of course, is also something that happens with those hundreds and thousands of members as they question every move you make as well.
Sure.
There's a lot more freedom to really explore the aspects of liberty in the way that I see them, the beauty, the kindness, and less of the very, and I hate to bring it up, but the brutalist versus the humanist kind of argument that's been going back and forth within libertarian circles recently, the thick versus thin libertarianism, all that stuff. You really do get to focus on the good that liberty can bring, and,
sure.
and that's really where I'm working right now. And in addition to the advocates, I'm also working on a side project called The Kind Libertarian, which really focuses on the super good, very encouraging, very enthusiastic, something that I have. It's just a passion project that I'm working on with a few friends from Georgia and some folks up here in Indiana. And it's just something to really help bring people around to the ideas of liberty from what it can do for you, and to encourage those of us who are libertarians that have kind of been beaten down by all of the negative that we get. It's really an encouraging and uplifting opportunity to express libertarianism.
Yeah, hold on just a second. I have to pontificate, and then you can ask a question, Greg. hold on, let me step up on my high horse here. Yeah, I really loved the transition, because party politics, and you see this in We Are Libertarians. If you go back and you listen to the early episodes of the show, and you listen when basically all the episodes before Greg, and you listen to those shows when it was Galt, Creighton, and I, it was more party focused, more politics focused, and that was because it was part of the Libertarian Party. And then when I left to take that job, I took We Are Libertarians with me, and really because they weren't going to do anything with it. And I've launched the website, started to do some of my own things, because then I could find people that I mostly agree with. I don't agree with everything Greg says or Gina or what you might say tonight or really everybody on the network, Maya. But I'm able to give them a voice and to kind of foster some of the stuff that we've done. Whereas before, I felt we've got to promote the candidates. We've got to promote the party. And that's first. And then promote the ideology. And the Libertarian Party, there's only one of them, with the advocates, Cato, Freedom, FEE, FREE, FFF. There's many different libertarian organizations out there that are great, and you can kind of pick and choose who you want to support. You know, maybe it's you're an economic libertarian and you want to support Mises and what they do, or you want to go to liberty.me and support what Jeffrey Tucker's doing financially.
We will have a guide on liberty.me.
Really?
Uh-huh. It's the one about the ultimate libertarian sales guide, that blog post. They're going to turn it into a guide that's going to be a We Are Libertarians guide.
That is awesome.
Very cool.
Very good. So if you don't know what liberty.me is, go back and listen to some of the past episodes, the last one with Jeffrey Tucker, who's amazing, and go check out liberty.me. But, yeah, there's only one Libertarian Party, and there's lots of different kinds of libertarians. There's a lot of different thoughts. We're all working towards the same goal, but we all have different roots, different temperaments, different views, different emphasis, different issues. And you can kind of pick and choose a little bit more where your money's going and where you can direct your criticism or favoritism in the nonprofit world. So I think that's a huge benefit. And so you'll notice in We Are Libertarians, you know, we launched in March of 2012, and then we got serious through 2013. We launched the new website in January. That's when Greg came on. That's when we started doing a lot of different shows. We've got a few different things planned that we're working for now, and we've had a bit of a break lately. The Dear Leader has had some personal issues. If you can't read between the lines, I am living on my own now and living in a different place. Mittens and I are very happy together here.
Can I have a little payback? Because I used to get crushed for living the bachelor, a.k.a. Lindsey Graham lifestyle. Welcome to my world, Chris.
I'm not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
No, not. I just want you, now that you too are in fact a Lindsey Graham-nesty, I just wanted to figure that out.
I was just asked to leave our former podcast location. Luckily, I was able
voluntarily.
I left the Libertarian Party. Luckily, I was able to bring We Are Libertarians with me here. But it's been tough as I've started a new job and transitioning that. It's kind of been tough to get into the rhythm and get back to things. So we're going to fall back into some of that rhythm again and start being more regular. And I'm going to put out stuff that I haven't edited or that has been in the can that we need to put out. We need to re-upload episode 81. Various things happened with that episode that we won't go into. A lot of behind-the-scenes drama that we won't go into any further than that.
We now have a new sponsor, Students for Liberty.
Stop. And so I just want to apologize to all the regular listeners, all the fans. I every week feel terrible that we don't get together to do a podcast, but I feel much worse about other things. And so now it's kind of ready to kind of break out of that and get back to normal a little bit. And please have patience. So we'll get there.
And if you're Josiah Crones, please listen to another show.
Listen, if you're Josiah Crones, I'm not going to tell you to kill yourself. I'm just going to say stop listening and stop breathing. I'm just saying.
Choke on a potato.
It's an inside joke. There's this listener who, the very first time I ever saw this jerk's name, he was saying, "Wow, Chris Spangle looks much fatter than I thought he was."
Wow.
And so Josiah,
Greg
went off. He was like, "That is so mean." I was kind of hurt by it.
I went Dick Cheney on him.
Right. I'm more George W. I'm like, I don't know what he's doing over there. It's terrible.
And I nuked his mother and every one of his ancestors in Afghanistan.
And so Josiah became the most hated listener of this program. We hate his guts because he once called me fat. And listen, after third grade, I'm not going to tolerate that anymore. All right.
He lives in Idaho. Right. They don't even have outdoor plumbing there yet.
I mean, the whole state is shaped like a potato.
I'm pretty sure he got on Facebook from one of those AOL discs. I can't prove it, but I'm just saying.
Ooh, what do you got, satellite internet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, anyways.
Only when he moves his tinfoil hat to the left or right.
Welcome to the podcast, Brett. This is divergence at its finest. This is what we're known for. You know, it's great.
Every episode that I've heard has been very divergent.
Right. Meaning every time you start it, you turn it right off. That is a common occurrence according to the statistics.
Can I ask a question about libertarian executive directing?
For
both your perspectives?
Yes, please. Sure.
Since it's the minority party, third party, why not instead of running, run candidates, but instead of hosting events and playing politics like politics is done, and since libertarians get hammered for not caring about, you know, people who are, you know, not well off or blah, 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 why not just turn every single event you ever do into a Feed the Homeless initiative?
Go ahead.
Well, actually, you pointed to the lack of electoral success in a roundabout way there. But I actually, as of today, I can no longer say it, but I was an elected libertarian.
Oh, no, I don't mean elected. I mean the branding, like the way people perceive libertarians. Like, oh, you don't believe in welfare? Why do you hate poor people?
As opposed
actually,
to...
that's something that I really advocated.
Right.
There was actually, near my home in Marietta, there was a bus stop that I saw every single day that I drove by for the county transit system. And I saw the need for a bench at that bus stop because I saw that they were bringing carts down from the grocery store, turning them on their side, ruining them as they were sitting on them. It became a haven for trash. And I thought, hey, you know, it would be a really cool project for my local LP affiliate is if we built a bench and we put a little mark on there that said, hey, this was provided by the Libertarian Party of Cobb County. I had even talked to the property owners and the store owners, and they were cool with the idea. The only thing that stopped me from doing it myself was that I am not handy at all. I have worked very, very hard not to ever get my hands dirty. That was the reason that I went to college. And not saying that there's anything wrong with that, but my whole life I've wanted to do more with my brain than with my body. And so I just did not have the ability to build that on my own, much like many of the projects that I was involved in where I was literally the only person that showed up. This was an idea that I thought had merit. I just didn't have the means to make it happen, and I wasn't going to pay somebody to do it because it seemed like a great volunteer opportunity because we did have crafty and handy people. I wanted to be involved with Habitat for Humanity. There were a lot of volunteer opportunities that I wanted us to take advantage of and get behind. But at the end of the day, there were a lot of people who just did not want to do anything. They would rather sit around and debate.
Sure. And this is the problem because I, too, had a lot of the same thoughts, a lot of the same ideas. And I think that if you work in it full time, you think that way. You think, okay, what is going to get us the best press? What is going to make the most impact in our community? What is going to branch out and reach a different group of people? Because, you know, I go to libertarian meetings and it's all white people. Or I go to libertarians and it's all computer programmers. Or I go to libertarian meetings and it's all X or Y or Z. And it's because the people that go to those meetings invite their friends, and their friends, it's birds of a feather that flock together. And so getting out and getting involved in the community, doing charity and wearing t-shirts that say Libertarian Party of whatever is something that Marion County here in Indianapolis did. They did a lot of that. They did an annual, you know, a couple different annual charity things and made it clear that it was from the Libertarian Party and publicized that. But I would have liked to have seen and would like to see more systematic volunteering, more community organizing, because I really think that community organizing, in a big way, is the reason that the left does community organizing is because when you do something nice for somebody else, they're more apt to adopt your ideas and say, you know what, they're all right. And it gives you a natural way to have a conversation about these ideas and about the ideas of what government could be without the state. And, you know, it's the reason it doesn't happen is because people in the groups, it's not that it's not pitched, it's that it's not what they're into. A lot of libertarians are just like, ooh, that means I'd have to talk to people.
I have an idea, though, because libertarians are huge into comic books, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
not me.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, no one actually in this room, but the majority, like I'd say probably at least 40% of libertarians are into that World of Warcraft, into World of Warcraft, into Batman comic books, all of those things. Since we always get hit with, what would you do without the police? Why not start a libertarian night watch group that are vigilantes like Batman?
Only if I get to wear my underpants on the outside.
What's funny about that is my former chairman of my local affiliate did organize a neighborhood watch for his area And that was something that he was actually very involved in. And it ended up that they were contacted by the city that we both lived in to find out how they could start more groups like that. It wasn't an official neighborhood watch, but it was a group of people. They were walking around the neighborhood. They were checking things out. They were making themselves feel safer. And it was something that was very successful, and they wanted to replicate it elsewhere. And I did want to add one more thing. I may not have been successful in having libertarians under the banner of Libertarian Party participate in some of those things, but as a candidate and as an elected official, I did do a significant amount of that because I had more control, more emphasis, more drive behind it, and I was able to inspire libertarians to do things like a back-to-school school supplies drive, where instead of, you know, we hear on a lot of the right-wing talk radio where they decry and detest the idea that when a child comes into a kindergarten classroom that all of their school supplies are kind of put in one communal box and doled out as they're needed throughout the school year. I took the opportunity when Georgia has a sales tax holiday right before the before school comes back into session. I took that as an opportunity to have a drop off and publicize this. It was called Marietta Give. And what we did was we organized people coming to give school supplies using the absence of taxation to show the prosperity that comes and to also see that in the absence of the state, you would still be able to provide for the less fortunate, the poorer people, the poorest in your community. I also did a book drive in the community, branded the same way with Marietta Give, for the Christmas season this past school year. Because I knew that literacy was a huge problem in my neighborhood school. It's a very poor area. And you know how you and I, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners, have books per people. The ratio is reversed in a lot of poor neighborhoods. It's people per book. In fact, in my neighborhood, at my neighborhood school, the principal told me that he estimated that it was probably 40 students per book among his student population. So we were able to bring together donations. People went to the used bookstore and purchased books. We did that ourselves, and we were able to provide 210 students at that school with a book to take home over Christmas break when they wouldn't have any contact with the school, because I thought it was important, and I didn't care what the book was about. I didn't care what language it was in, because it was a very heavily Hispanic area, so Spanish is a very strong language there, but it was an opportunity for us to touch children in the community in a good way, not in a creepy way, but to give them an opportunity to increase their literacy, to increase their reading skills. And again, it was done. The only form of government was the fact that I was elected and that I was, you know, giving the books to the principal so that they could make sure that, you know, what was donated, because I don't have children. So I wanted to make sure that what was donated wasn't explicit, wasn't inappropriate for their age range. But we focused on the elementary school, and there's actually another one going on right now that will be happening for the end of school, so that over the summer they're going to have them. We've collected about 110 books. And when I return later this month, as everything gets moved up here to Indiana, we'll actually be giving those books to the local principal to distribute to the kids that really, really do need them. And so I think that when you see stuff like that, you're going to see – everybody knows that I'm a libertarian. Everybody knows about those things that I did. It was praised by everybody. And the thing is they could have done it themselves, but it took a libertarian who saw that in the absence of government, you could do it.
What it comes down to is it's a personality problem in the libertarian movement. And I'll just be real honest, because I'm like this, and I'm sure most of the people listening are like this. It's uncomfortable to go out and volunteer. It's uncomfortable to go out and meet the people, shake the babies, kiss the hands. Wait.
Well, and a lot of that has to do with personality. There are a lot of introverts in the Libertarian Party and
the
Libertarian Movement.
Well, the other problem is laziness.
That is a problem,
and so
too.
Sometimes I think that we just make an excuse for ourselves because We're all just a little bit introverted.
We're social media killers, though.
Right.
You know, but...
But the fact is there's a lot of people who want to do that armchair quarterbacking. They want to be the fantasy football players. They don't want to be Emmett Smith. They want to pick Emmett Smith for their fantasy football team. And we need people like Brett who just see a need and go and fill it. They don't form a committee to figure out how it's going to get done. They don't talk around in circles. I mean, there's a lot of... You know what I see a lot of times in libertarian circles? There's this great old poem. You know, anybody could have done it, but nobody could have seen it. You know, it's like about a chicken. And I posted it one time, and you reposted it, Brett, where it's about these chickens where anybody could have done it, but somebody didn't do it. So everybody thought that anybody was going to do it. And it's... And I'll try and find it and repost it. But, you know, there's a lot of... Well, let's, if we form a committee or if we get together at a business meeting and talk about some of these things, that is equal to it actually being done. And that's just not the case. You've got to just do it and stop. You know, I'm a get it done type of person. If I see a need, I just do it. I'm not going to ask somebody. And if I can't do it or if I know somebody who has better skills at doing something, I'll call and ask them to do it. You just got to communicate with people. You got to see those needs, and you just got to be the proactive person that says, this needs filled. Can I do it? No. Who can do it? How can I help assist that person do it? And so while we are introverts and we like to say that we're introverted, a lot of libertarians are just lazy as hell and they just want to talk about doing stuff. They want to talk about libertarianism. I know it's hilarious because we're on a podcast right now talking about doing stuff. And like Brett and I have earned our stripes, but I can tell you right now, we're not doing anything right now other than talking about it. But, well, you do it on a daily basis. I have a different job.
He's got
job
these
now.
Cats.
I've got cats. I've got crying. Crying is my new best friend. No.
Well, it does help that I'm alone in a strange land.
Right.
And have been for the last couple of weeks and look to be for the next couple of weeks. But.
Yeah. So you got to kind of, like, I'm in a season in my life where I'm not done with politics, direct action politics forever. I'll never run for office, but I certainly have built up a lot of skills and knowledge that I can help assist campaigns, talk with candidates, train people, do this, you know. But right now, I just kind of need to not focus on that stuff, not do those sorts of things. And I think there are a lot of people who, you get burned out. I did it for 10 years. I did it day to day, in and out, grinded it out for 4 years at the Libertarian Party and did everything. And so you got to kind of take some time, but I'll be back.
You need to be more David Friedman and less Chris Spangler.
We'll talk about that later if we get time. So you just got to get off your butts and do some of those things. So welcome to Indiana. Now, you said you were elected to office. How
yes.
the heck did you do that? What office and how did you get elected?
I was on the Marietta City School Board. There was a special election that took place in 2012. Much like my term ended, the guy before me got a job in a different state that caused him to relocate. And I ran for office. It came down to a conversation that was headed up by our neighborhood group. When the previous holder of that seat won, there was a lot of animosity that carried throughout the neighborhood, and they wanted to make sure that with the special election that there was a lot of harmony. And so really we all kind of, if we had any inclination to run, we were all invited to kind of sit down and talk about it. And really, I was the only person that people were afraid of running against because they knew that I had political experience.
Right.
They knew that I had a, quote, army of libertarians that would come and knock on doors.
Or were they afraid of Chris Spangle?
They were not afraid of Chris Spangle.
No.
Not at all.
Much but, like everyone else in the world, they said, who the hell is that?
But so President I was able to
walk
in. I was able to walk in the first time in the special election. I got 98% of the vote. There were four people that wrote somebody else in. I believe Mickey Mouse got a vote, Donald Duck, Ronald Reagan, and then somebody wrote themselves in for the position. So that was how I got elected the first time. The second time was not as easy. I drew two challengers. It was a three-way race, But as I detailed, on my personal blog, brettbittner.com, I actually targeted the message and I looked at, you know, there's 8,800 people in the area that I would represent, roughly 8,800 people. And I narrowed it down to the ones that I thought would vote and that I could influence their vote. And so for me, it was a matter of getting out there and talking to people and knocking on doors. I knew I had an incumbent advantage. I knew I had the last name advantage in terms of appearing higher on the ballot. But I wasn't satisfied with that. Georgia is a runoff state. And so if I didn't get 50% plus one, I was going to have to campaign for another month. And that was really my motivation in July when it's 105 degrees and 100% humidity and you feel like you're swimming when you're outside walking, for me to go door to door. And I knocked on 1,500 doors. Some of them I knocked on twice. But I made sure that people knew who I was. I kept a very consistent branding. I kept a very consistent message. Much like Mitt Romney, I was like a robot when it came to the issues and the script, because I knew exactly what I wanted people to know about me. And I used that throughout the entire campaign. And then people were also seeing me at every single event that their kids participated in. Mm-hmm. If it was a night like tonight, then I would be doing an interview or a podcast or working with something. Or if I had an event with a Libertarian Party, I'd be doing that. But if it was a night like last night for me, instead of going to Chick-fil-A and mooching off of their Wi-Fi for a while, because where I'm staying, the Wi-Fi sucks, I would have been at an event at one of the schools, whether it was high school, middle school, elementary school, arts, sports. As long as it wasn't basketball, I was pretty much there. And so they saw me in the community, they saw me at the events, they saw me in their schools, and they saw what was happening outside of the boardroom, and I was showing up at their door. I had one lady who was drawn into the ward that I represented. She had lived there for 12 years, and she said she had never been visited by any candidate ever. She'd gotten mailers, she'd gotten robocalls, but she'd never had anybody come to her door and talk to her about the issues that she felt were important. And when she looked down at the push card that I handed her when I introduced myself and looked up at me and said, "You're him, right?" I said, "Yep, that's me." She said, "Oh my God, I can't believe it." And she gave me a hug. And I didn't understand what it was about, but it was because somebody was there that in her mind had a position of authority and wanted to listen to what she had to say.
Right.
And I made that connection with a lot of people in the city of Marietta, not just in my ward, but throughout the city, throughout Cobb County. And you know what? As many times as the newspaper and TV and radio wanted to slap the Libertarian label on me to try to detract from that support, what they really did was they strengthened people's belief in the idea that Libertarians aren't these crazy wacko nut jobs. They can be very normal people who are very engaged and very involved in their community. And they were happy to support me. And I think it actually helped not only me, but also the brand of Libertarianism to see my name attached to that with every single time I was mentioned in the media.
Yeah, so what are the Libertarian Party of Indiana just had their convention.
How was it?
Shut up.
I wouldn't know either.
Yeah, I had personal issues and I couldn't go this year. Why didn't you go, Greg? You're the new great white libertarian in the state of Indiana.
No, this Roger Paxton, the head of the
Arkansas.
He called me a neocon in a comment because he knew Bittner made a post saying he was going to be on tonight. And he was like, "Well, that's better than that neocon guy that wants to bomb everybody." And I was like, Are you even a state? Like, he's just lucky that Rick Perry doesn't annex Arkansas like the Ukraine.
Roger Paxton is or was the chair of the Libertarian Party of Arkansas.
He was. He's now their secretary.
Okay. And is an awesome guy.
Sounds like a demotion to me.
He has
his wife is the chair, actually.
He has... so it's nepotism.
Yep.
Nepotism in Arkansas.
Corrupt. Don't be a Libertarian Party member in Arkansas.
Actually, I was there at their convention, and the Paxtons were very gracious. They actually gave me my first opportunity to provide a keynote address.
Cool.
At their convention. I was there. There was no funny business with the voting. No nepotism, Chris. Sorry.
I think I nominated...
The Paxtons are great people.
Yeah, I think I nominated...
No.
I think I nominated Roger for Judicial Committee at the National Convention in Vegas, after a lovely meal at a Vegas buffet at the Red Rock Inn. No, they're awesome people. They're doing great. If you live in Arkansas, you seriously need to get in touch with the Paxtons and get on it.
I don't like them. They are my Southern Crohn's.
Yeah.
They are my Southern Crohn's disease.
Just because he accurately described you as a person that wants to bomb other countries, you can't get mad at him.
I will not be dictated to about wanting to bomb other countries from someone that lives in Arkansas, and they probably have a database of where anyone that's even tan lives.
See, I guess I can't get mad at you because I got mad at Josiah for accurately describing me as fat, so.
He did not. That's not true.
What? I'm just big bone.
You're Canadian.
Shut up. You a-hole. So, let's talk about libertarian candidates, and we'll get to old racist and Bundy ranches and all that stuff in a minute. But I find it fascinating. I want to talk about the Libertarian Party for the first time in like a year and a half. So a lot of states have their conventions. The National Convention for the Libertarian Party is in Ohio, in Columbus, Ohio, at the end of June. So a lot of campaigns are starting up. You know, here in Indiana, we have the Secretary of State campaign with Carl Tagenhorst. He is running for our ballot access position. There's also several statewide and federal-level candidates.
And what a sharp, intelligent guy, Carl.
Yep. And Andy Horning is running in District 8. A lot of great people running across the state of Indiana. And check your local listings, I'm sure, where you're at, too. So as a person who spent 4 years...
4.5 years with the Libertarian Party of Georgia.
All right. So relatively the same experience. Like, we were the two. Over the course of 4 years, we were the two executive directors. And I'm not sure. Are there other executive directors?
There are now. LP Texas has an executive director. I believe that position is paid. Washington State has one. Mm. North Carolina has one. I'm not sure if that position is paid. I did do some work for the Libertarian Party of North Carolina in 2012 and 2013 to really kickstart some of their initiatives and get them really going in a positive direction after they had some leadership changes. And I want to say that there's another Western state that has...
Colorado has a really big party.
Colorado has a strong party. Maybe, or I know that California always has some form of staff. So, yeah, so they're few and far between. So as a person who has trained a lot of candidates, talked to a lot of candidates... Let's talk about the good and let's talk about the bad.
Okay.
Let's start with the bad. What are some of the don'ts that candidates should do if they're running for office?
Some of the don'ts. Well, the first don't that I have, and everybody in Georgia is going to expect me to say this, do not under any circumstances wear a Hawaiian shirt to a statewide televised debate on purpose. I'm not going to name names, but that was probably the most furious I've ever been. Took place in October of 2010. My reaction, it was probably the most angry, the most furious, just the most pissed off I've ever been in my entire life.
Sure.
In public. And I let the emotions of that get out there. So everybody knows what I'm talking about that is involved in Georgia. I won't
Right.
name names about who it was. But that was... that was one of the things. The other thing is...
Let's talk about that. Because
okay.
there's a strong impulse amongst independent candidates, libertarian candidates, minority party candidates, to draw attention to themselves.
Yeah, they think that gimmicks are going to win.
Gimmicks are going to win because if they can just get attention, then people will hear how great their ideas are. And that's a weird impulse because if you see somebody, it's you can be different. Like, I'm the guy who helped with Rupert Bonham's campaign who ran for Survivor. You know, he ran for governor, he was on Survivor. You can be different, but you still got to fit within people's perception of what that job that you're applying for.
But the difference with Rupert was this, and I actually, when I first met Rupert, he's a friend, so I'm not going to say what I really thought at first. But... I thought that it was more of that gimmicky nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the beard and the tie-dye, that it was stupid. And then I walked down the street with him in downtown Indianapolis during the Super Bowl week
right.
in 2012.
When it was here.
When it was here in Indy, and I was here, and I was working on his campaign a little bit, and I was thinking, oh, great, this is another stupid campaign that's doing something gimmicky, and my goal the first week was to Chris Spangle him into shaving the beard and not wearing tie-dye. And then we went to lunch one day at the Arby's that was down the street from his campaign office.
And it took an hour and a half to get there.
I had budgeted 15 minutes to walk there and back, including the time to get the food, and it took us over an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Because people stopped, and they saw him, and they recognized him. There were people that were running across the street in front of cars that were coming at them just so they would have the opportunity to say hello, shake his hand, and have their picture taken. Mm-hmm. I got to be an amazing camera phone photographer
yep.
during the time that I worked with Rupert. And, you know, that is the exception.
Sure.
It is not the rule. He has yeah. name ID. He has a brand. And I didn't know it because I wasn't a Survivor fan then. I am now, but I wasn't then.
The other part of it is he had substance, and people would wait in line anywhere from 15 to 60 minutes. I mean, there was at one point at a Pride Festival in Lafayette where people were waiting almost 90 minutes consistently throughout the evening to meet Rupert, talk to him, get his autograph. What other libertarian candidate gets a line that long of people who can be talked to, can have literature put in their hands? I mean, we talked to hundreds and hundreds of people about the libertarian message at events like Pride festivals where people are politically minded, but it's not a political event necessarily, and you're there supporting them. You know, it just was a great opportunity for us to spend 20 minutes just pounding people for donations to sell t-shirts so they'll take our brand with them, and also to put the world's smallest political quiz in their hand. The quiz went with us wherever we went. The quiz was in his literature to have people take the test, and you know, most people score in that libertarian quadrant, and it just was a great way. You know, a lot of people dismissed it as a gimmick. I did too. I was like, I'll go meet with the guy, but we're not running Snooki for governor, you know? And then you spend 3 hours with him and you see the substance and what he's built, his charity, his character.
He lives it.
He is.
One of those fraudulent celebrities. Yeah.
He walks the walk, which is right. something I think is lacking with a lot of libertarians. We talked about that earlier.
And politicians, period. Candidates,
agreed,
period.
Because so much of it is fake. It's staged photo ops.
The other part of it is he had Evan McMahon, who just was completely committed to his campaign, worked for like a year and a half without a paycheck, gave his heart and soul to that campaign, who was organized, who got those materials designed and printed, got the website out there, guided Rupert, molded him. You know, we had practice debates. You know, there are candidates like Andy Horning who shine in the debate, and people walk away going, you know, I really like that guy. Rupert was not necessarily the most polished debater, but when you're out with him on the stump one-on-one, he had that quality where he just grabbed you, made you feel special, and you walked away with his literature in his pocket. And I think to go to the from the bad to the good, the bottom line is don't try to be gimmicky. Stick to your 3 points.
And be authentic. People can tell when you're fake.
Right.
They really can.
When you're playing a character, you got to know what you're talking about. You got to talk about things that matter. When Brett went out running for school board and was talking to people about school board issues, he was not talking about ending the Fed. He was not talking about ending wars. He was not talking about anything other than school board.
It was local control, community involvement.
Right.
And it was about really making the schools a welcoming place and student achievement.
I think a lot of times we have a debate in the libertarian movement, the Libertarian Party more than Republican libertarians. Is it about education or is it about running for office? You know, does the Libertarian Party exist as an educational tool to build some sort of structure so that we can have events, net other libertarians, bring them into the movement, educate them better so they can go out and evangelize to their friends and family, and they emphasize less running for office, winning those offices, serving in government, dealing with lawmaking? dealing with tough issues, dealing with issues as they present themselves, versus a group, a more pragmatic group who say, listen, we're involved in politics. That's rule number one. The goal of the party is to win elections, to serve in government, and to reform the government from the inside out. And I land somewhere in between, because I think that a Brett Bittner who is not a right libertarian, I would say that you're probably more of a left libertarian.
Sure.
If you want to qualify.
Just based on the issues that, sure, that I focus on. Yeah.
Right.
I would say I look at more of the left libertarian.
Yeah, and issues. You know, you and you more than I, but I also try to be middle of the road, especially in the Libertarian Party. Just kind of float between both camps, be friendly with everybody, not get involved in all the issues. The advocates are great at that. Sharon Harris gets along with everybody. I love that quality. Stay out of the drama. Don't pick fights, because that's not the point of the party. Stay away from the infighting. You know, you ran for school board. You won your race. You educated people about, because of your hard work, you not only educated people about what was going on in their government, you also educated them about libertarian principles, and you were able to do things inside the system and outside the system to benefit your community, move it more towards libertarian principles. I don't see the harm in that. You educated people while you also were serving your community, and you know. But then there are people like Maya who probably don't have an invalid point. Where how can you work in the government to get rid of the government? You know, and hey, c'est la vie, and we'll have Maya on very soon. She's been itching to come back, and the fact that you're on and she's not tonight means I will get the nastiest note on the planet. So I have to make that uncomfortable phone call after you leave. God love Maya. I can't wait to have her back on so she can leave in a fit of rage. But the question is, Greg, am I emotionally stable enough to handle Maya on the show?
You know what? No. But then again, Deepak Chopra isn't emotionally stable enough to handle my own.
When
show.
I was stable and comfortable and doing well mentally and emotionally, I couldn't handle my on the show.
Maya is the only person I've ever seen make Joel Osteen consider atheism.
I saw Joel Osteen standing on a bridge considering jumping last week, and it was because of Maya.
And it was just a look. Maya didn't even have to say anything. It was just purely a look.
Oh my. So we're going to be we're gonna have Maya on very soon. So sorry, man. A lot of shenanigans going on behind the scenes for as we discuss future guests. So anyways, I would consider there are probably 3-4 places that I consider hotbeds of libertarianism, especially in our generation. I would say that Atlanta, from which you are leaving, is a hotbed of young libertarianism. You've got Fee down there. You've got the advocates down there. You've got a solid, active party thanks to your work with the Libertarian Party of Georgia. I would say Austin and the Texas crowd in Austin and Dallas. They're a very solid, strong, active group of young libertarians. Virginia, obviously, because it's of its proximity. And then here in Indianapolis, proximity to D.C., I didn't finish my thought. And then here in Indianapolis, we have a lot of young libertarians, a lot of, obviously, that's where we're broadcasting out of. So we're happy to have you in Indianapolis. So you
New Hampshire, the biggest one.
Oh, you're totally right.
I mean,
yeah.
If anyone is a free stater that listens, or, yes, you know, you guys are definitely the leaders.
I'm an idiot. 5.
And don't forget about Colorado. I mean,
Colorado? Yep.
I've really seen, I was at their 2013 state convention. Mm-hmm. When I was serving as chairman of LSLA, we held our annual meeting there, and I got to know a lot of the Colorado folks, and I was really impressed with what they've been able to do. And I believe they put 50 candidates on the ballot this year.
Wow.
The Up and Smoke Tour.
I would say there's got to be California as well, LA, and also sort of the Sacramento area.
It gets diluted, though, because of the sheer, yeah, overwhelming number of liberals.
Sure. So, yeah, gladly, there are many growing little pockets of libertarianism. Indianapolis, I'd love to say that that's one of them. And you're totally right about New Hampshire. To all our free staters, if we're back on LRN.FM, all our friends in Keene, we say
Good on ya.
Tally ho. I don't know what you say in New Hampshire.
Porcupine up.
Porcupine it on up, bitches. All right. Should we dive into issues?
Well, we do have someone from the South on the show, so...
Right, so naturally we had to talk about racism.
Exactly, how could we not?
We did make him, before we started the show, being a Southerner, we made him. We said, you can come on the show, but on air, you must admit that Sherman did nothing wrong.
He didn't do anything wrong.
Oh, you guys.
I mean, what did he do wrong? And don't give me that states' rights argument, okay?
Y'all,
that's just racist.
Y'all, here's the thing. I grew up in the area that he went through.
Right.
He it's like Bush. He liberated it.
Well, I'm not going to argue in any way, shape, or form that the Confederacy was any bastion of liberty by any stretch of the imagination.
One would argue slavery is the exact opposite.
I would actually stand with you in that argument.
Go on, Brett Bundy.
The issue that I saw... and the issue that I see is the 10th Amendment means nothing if you cannot back out of the contract, the Constitution.
Uh-oh. Oh, now we're getting into legal theory.
Somebody just bought season tickets to the Clippers.
Oh, boy.
Well, so, it doesn't have anything to do with race.
Do you have any black followers on Instagram? Because that might make me upset.
Oh, I'm not even sure what that means.
Donald Sterling, the conversation.
That's the whole issue. His minority sidekick taped it when he was yelling at her for being friends with minorities on Instagram.
Ah, Magic Johnson, yes. Who actually has a Bridgescape charter school in Georgia that I am very friends with the superintendent of. Ah. Very good friends with.
Name dropper.
Monica Henson is the superintendent, and she'll probably end up listening just because I was on the show, so I want to make sure that
shout out.
She knows that she's a
She
good.
Knows magic.
She works at the Bridgescape school.
If I ever get AIDS, I want some of that blood.
Stop it.
Oh, stop it.
See, that's the funny part about the Donald Sterling thing. I believe she made love to Magic Johnson.
Yes.
And he was upset about a picture on Instagram. He was not upset about being exposed to the HIV virus.
No.
So this guy clearly is a person who has his priorities straight.
Well,
social media photos? No.
HIV, though? You know, I'll tell you, though, race, the South changes people. It changes people. No, right. But, no. So sorry, Brett. We're trolling you so hard, but it's what we do to first-time guests.
Listen,
this is the gauntlet, my friend.
This is what you have to get through. We're going to call you a racist. We're going to call you. We're going to.
It won't be the first time.
Test you. Let's get into race in a minute. Let's talk about the Bundy Ranch, but let's not talk about the Bundy Ranch in terms of what this D-bag said.
Yeah.
Let's talk about what actually happened. Give a brief overview, because property rights are so central to libertarianism, and this just goes to the heart of property rights issues. And I know we're about a week late, and that is my fault on this issue, but I do think it's worth mentioning and touching on it. I know a little bit about it. I haven't studied it in depth. So as always, we go to our news correspondent, the always informed, the never tactful Greg Lenz. Please.
I appreciate such an incredibly nice opening for
the
me.
The always informed, never tactful Greg Lenz.
Well, this is why I always hate this, is that I'm sure our audience obviously knows it even better than I do, but Clive and Bundy is in a little bit of a standoff with some federal agents of the Federal Land Bureau and Management.
BLM.
Bureau of Land Management. And it seems to me that he is in the middle of a 10th Amendment, in fact, fight. He is under the impression that because his family has been grazing these lands with their cattle since the 1870s, which was before Nevada was even Nevada, that if he has to pay grazing rights and fees to anyone, he's paying them to the state of Nevada, not to the federal government, which actually quasi, I guess you could say, own the land. They own the land, but what can't they own? They're the government. They can own whatever they want, especially with eminent domain. And so he's in a little bit of a standoff. He's had some cattle shot, and the fees, in fact, are $1.35 per head of cattle per month. So he owes them a little over $1 million, correct? I think that was the last figure I read.
Yes, $1 million. The other part of this is back in 1993. This is one of those infamous stories that you hear about all the time. There's some endangered turtle that is on this specific area of land, and so that's why this fee was imposed. And it was essentially to discourage any kind of cattle ranching in this area because it might hurt the turtle. And the turtle's endangered. And so we don't want to grow food. We want to save a turtle.
What's tough, though, too, though, is he said they've been there since the 1870s.
Mm-hmm.
There are property records in his county that show that his family didn't move there until 1978.
Oh, really?
The Bundys moved from Bundyville, Arizona, in fact, to Bunkerville, Nevada, where he is, in fact, located.
So the... But the land has been settled for a heck of a long time, and back in 93, they imposed these fees on the cattle ranchers, and all of his neighbors bought in, and slowly their farms died out, and they faded away, and he said, you're not going to run my business because you arbitrarily decided to save the turtle, because the Bureau of Land Management can at any moment decide that they are the authority. So they go to court. And when they make an argument in court, they are in fact making law. So it's not like Congress is passing a law. Congress has given the BLM and many other executive branches the ability to make law, essentially make rules, regulations, and laws.
Enforcement.
And so the BLM made these rules and. Clive Bundy, whatever this dude's name is.
Cliven.
Cliven has decided, I'm going to fight it. I'm not going to give in. I own my land, and they're not going to just arbitrarily decide that I don't. So he's been in court for many, many years. He continually has lost. He owes $1 million in these back fees. And so the federal government spent $3 million doing what?
Well, they killed two of his cattle, or is it three?
I thought the number was closer to six.
Is it? I don't know.
It's six head of cattle. Again, this isn't something that I've been...
It's hard to get good news coverage on it, period, which
right,
is really shocking.
Everything that you're seeing is very glossed over.
It's from local affiliates, mainly. And then you have militiamen showing up.
Right.
You have a huge... If I am a Nevada citizen, I am livid at Harry Reid, because Harry Reid has called the Bundys domestic terrorists. You have cops, they tasered a supporter, a militiaman, and they even threatened, they have everything under surveillance right now, and then they have sniper rifles pointed at his property and at the disputed area and his cattle 24/7. I don't even know how to describe it, because it's, to me, it's like there isn't a cool head anywhere involved that can even come in and mediate.
Right.
And not only is there not a cool head, it shows that on both sides of what's going on, this has escalated beyond where it should have. I believe in some respects, both sides are wrong. And like everything that is out there, if there are two parties involved, there are three stories. There's one side, the other side, and the truth. And unfortunately, we really don't know what the truth is, because we are talking about an area of the country where it's hard to get a reliable news. And a lot of what we're seeing coming out of there is slanted in either is a pro-government position, propaganda-ish, or is very
natural
pro
news.
Bundy, not a real news source like an InfoWars or
yeah.
a Natural News or CNS. You know, so those, they're not legitimate in terms of what the mainstream would consider a legitimate news source, or as I like to always rail on people who use the Daily Mail as a news source, it is a tabloid, it has a slant, it's there to get you to talk about the things that they want you to talk about.
Let's also pause and take a moment just to reinforce the fact that we do not consider Prison Planet, InfoWars, Alex Jones, Natural News, Before It's News, or any of those sources to be credible or reliable information. And if you are sharing them on your Facebook, I probably have unfollowed you because it's not. And it drives me crazy when Drudge links to it, because he's giving credibility to speculation.
But he also, Drudge owes, I mean, the reason why is Drudge owes his entire career to two things, is two times he's hit right. The first time was on the Lewinsky scandal, linking to a non-credible news source. The second time was on John Edwards, linking to the National Enquirer before anyone else would touch it. So, like, for Drudge, I get it, but he is so darn credible. I mean, what's he drive, $100 billion, or, you know... $100 billion
traffic is unreal.
So, like, he's going to do that because if he gets one right, the payoff's enormous.
It's the same reason that TMZ is popular.
Yeah.
I just have a feeling. Like, I used to think Paula Deen, like, as soon as the cameras went off on Paula Deen, she's like, take care, y'all. Enjoy your butter, y'all. And then the cameras would go off and she'd be like, everybody stop looking at me, you motherfuckers. You know, like, she just... And I think that's basically been proven true. Although, in her defense, the people recanted and said all the stuff that made her lose her empire we made up. But that didn't get reported at all. The feeling I have with Alex Jones is that he's completely disingenuous and that he is using this to milk it for money and he is taking advantage of people who believe him.
Yes.
And
he exploits people.
The right. Perfect example of that is what he did with the supposed interview that Charlie Sheen had with Barack Obama. This was probably 2008, 2009.
The winning years?
It was unreal.
Right.
How many people he strung along with that. And then you go through the entire quote-unquote interview that, of course, everybody believed because Charlie Sheen, at the time, was a pretty big hotshot celebrity. Of course he's going to be able to get into the same room as the president, and he might even be able to talk about some of these things. And then you get down to the bottom and you find out that it was all fake.
Right.
That is the biggest example. That is the one that, for me, there's nothing that he can do to redeem himself
but
after that came out.
I will say, the dude is an entertainer. He knows how to hold an audience. He knows how to get an attention. And he has built a media empire that is unparalleled outside of the major networks. Now, he's done it with salacious information and half-truths.
He panders, man.
Right. But I respect the cut of this guy's jib, okay? I'm just saying.
He's a capitalist.
I wish that Wall had that kind of jib, okay? Meaning money. So, anyways, back to Clive and Bundy. The heart of this is property rights.
And the Constitution. That's the real interesting, mm-hmm. the most interesting part of all of it.
So, we're going to break this up. We're going to have Brett Bittner explain why property rights are central to libertarianism, if you're comfortable with that.
Absolutely.
Because we're throwing you a curveball.
No problem.
And then you will explain why this is central to the Constitution, because he's the anarchist and you, sir, are the statist. So,
oh boy, I'm
watch out, Paxton.
I don't know if you even are an anarchist.
Oh, geez. All I know is I'm never libertarian enough.
I know. Even if you were a voluntarist, you wouldn't be libertarian enough.
Right.
The right flavor of voluntarist.
Antonio Bueller is not libertarian enough for Christopher Cantwell, who is not libertarian enough for somebody else.
For the Free State Project.
Sure. So, yeah, well, there's a whole... Yeah. Anyways. Right. So why are property rights central to libertarianism?
Because it's my stuff, man.
All right, go.
Don't touch my stuff. Don't steal my stuff. It belongs to me. That's the very essence of what property rights are. It defines your body, your possessions, your money, your belongings, your relationships. Those things are mine, and they belong to me, and I should be able to do with them as I wish, because I have either traded part of my life, my liberty, or other parts of my property to obtain them. And when you infringe on that, whether you're another individual or you are the government, you are really stepping in it when it comes to libertarian thought. Because if it doesn't belong to the person that quote-unquote owns it, then it doesn't belong to anyone, and it's all subject to the tragedy of the commons. So at the end of the day, you can't have rule of law without being able to establish property rights. And I think that's where a lot of libertarian, it's a cornerstone of libertarianism, a lot of libertarian thought coming from that, because as I like to break down, I like to borrow words from my friend John J. Myers in Texas, libertarianism breaks down to 7 words and 2 sentences. It's leave me alone and don't steal my stuff. And if you can get that, you get all of it. Even Matt Kibbe with his new book, Matt Kibbe from FreedomWorks, it's don't hurt people and don't take their stuff. He gets it as well. It comes down to being able to own yourself, being able to govern yourself, being able to manage yourself. It comes down to yourself. Then it extends to your family, your home, the property that you have traded your life, your liberty or your property to get, because you're trading your life when you go to work to earn a paycheck to be able to purchase the new iPad or whatever it is that you're into.
But that sounds very selfish.
And it's selfish in that you're not giving it to other people. But you know what? If they wanted it bad enough, they would trade their life, their liberty, or their property for it.
Right. So what about the government and the property that the government owns? Why can't the government take your property?
Well, at the end of the day, who owns it? Who owns you? That's really a central question to ask and answer. I believe that an individual owns himself. He belongs to himself, and your home, your belongings, your family, those are extensions of you.
The things that you've worked hard to pay for. You put your sweat equity into a job, and in exchange, you get money back for it.
Right, which is just a medium of exchange. You're really, it's a way for you to trade part of your life, the sweat equity that Chris talked about, for something that you desire.
So to expound on that, when you get property, you get property two ways. You either take something and improve it. For instance, it's the
homestead.
You homestead it. It's like the pencil. A lot goes into the making of a pencil. The graphite, the wood, the rubber, the aluminum. You don't own all those things. I don't know. I'm not explaining it right. I'm a rusty. I've been distracted.
Ultimately,
but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, it all comes down to this.
Help.
The libertarian perspective starts here, and it starts with the homestead principle, in that because I am using this property that I consider mine to its most productive use, it is in fact mine.
But you have to be very careful with that, because there are people in government who would say, but you aren't using it for its highest and best use.
In the view of
that individual or
the
that
collective.
Entity.
Right. Which, since libertarians, the individual is the social unit of analysis, it is purely your perspective.
Sure. So the way that property is gained, there's two ways. There's the exchanging of money. You either trade goods, or you exchange time for money, and then you go and exchange your money for goods, or you take something and you improve it. You homestead a land that was open, that was claimed by no one, and you build a house on it. So you improve the value of the land, and that becomes your property. Government doesn't own property. Government claims it for itself or takes it from other people. When the government, on behalf of the collective, this isn't. You can't argue with it. When you collect taxes, you are taking money from people who worked for that money. So it is now May 1st. We have spent the last January, February, March, April, the last 4 months working for the government. All those 4 months of work that you put in to earn money went to some level of government.
See, the South did win.
And then the next rest of the year, you get to keep all that money. So,
except for sales taxes and some of the other aspects of
grazing fees
that aren't considered. Right. User fees as well.
Right. And so the problem with the Bureau of Land Management is that Clive and Bundy bought this land, settled this land, improved the land, made it better, took an interest in the land. He has a vested interest in making sure that his land is in tip-top shape so he can raise his cattle, they produce as much meat as possible. I don't know what kind of cattle they were. Were they, like, for feed or what the heck?
Well, if they certainly wouldn't be dairy, because they wouldn't be out grazing.
No,
they'd be in a stall.
So it's like Angus and hamburger.
Yeah,
and
it would have to be for meat, or possibly to help propagate the species for other farmers.
Sure. So he has a vested interest in making sure that his investment in the cattle, he gets his investment out of that. So he's going to take care of the land better than the Bureau of Land Management. And if there's a few turtles that get killed, who cares?
But that's the hard part about attaching your wagon to Bundy, is that he was, in my opinion, he was a freeloader. He just didn't want to pay, period, because becoming a rancher was so difficult at this point, it was hard to even squeak out a living.
We'll get to Bundy himself. We're talking about the principles. Bundy himself, this is the danger of attaching yourself to an individual and not an idea, is once that individual shows their true colors, then the ideas get tarnished. So the bottom line is his property is his property, and the Bureau of Land Management has decided that they're going to tell him how to run his property because they think they know that they know better than he does, and they may not necessarily know better than he does. But you say there's a constitutional aspect to this as well.
There definitely is, because if, and granted, it looks like that was actually a fraudulent claim, but if his family was there before Nevada was a state that was admitted to the Union, then the authority that his family would have recognized would have been the Nevada state government. So you get into the question of what Brett brought up earlier. Is the Constitution a contract or is it not? Are you able to void the contract or can you not? Was the Civil War a war of, how do you like to say?
A war of northern aggression. Does that sound familiar to you, Brett?
I might have heard it a time or two or 100 million right. times.
It was a war of northern aggression.
Although they don't say it quite that poorly.
You, sir, have never been to Savannah. This is my Savannah accent.
And it's not even close.
Get this guy a mint julep.
Right now.
But anyway, so it always comes down to the question, did the states create the federal government, or is it like the preamble says, we the people?
Well, one thing to consider, though, is that Nevada wasn't a state until after the Civil War. So you would, in essence, if you do agree that the Civil War was not, as Chris said, the war of northern aggression, or you do not recognize the 10th Amendment or the right to secede or the right to void that contract, then you would say that any state that enters the Union after that point, because the precedent has been set that you cannot do that, as Lincoln showed and as the Union Army showed, then you would be accepting that despite having been there before it became a state and was admitted to the Union, you would be subjecting yourself to the same situation that the South found themselves in on April 15th, 1865.
Except for Texas, which can always just press a button and kind of be like Transformers and turn into five separate states, right?
You know, I'm pretty sure that is just something that we hear about, but no, I've never actually seen.
In the Texas Constitution, they can turn into four states if they decide to secede.
But you know what? Why haven't they done it? I mean, they have the opportunity. They have the guy in place who says he's going to do it.
Is the juice worth the squeeze? And then would the citizens revolt? And they would.
Yeah.
That's the thing. But I tend to be of the state of mind that if they had just written we the states in the Constitution, this would have all been taken care of. This
would have
been
so much easier. But then you don't have individuals.
I know. But
the collective within an imaginary line.
I know.
And then you have things like the Georgia-Tennessee boundary dispute with regard to the Tennessee River and whatever parallel that is. You have issues with regard to the Savannah River and the harbor there being dredged and deepened, where it requires the cooperation of both South Carolina and Georgia for it to happen. You have areas of Illinois that have seceded from the state and the federal government to form their own country. You have parts of California that are wanting to break apart. You know,
the Republic of Northern Colorado that's on the verge of happening.
You have four counties in Colorado. So, you know, at the end of the day, you really do have to look at we the people is the correct term, because I don't believe that states have rights. I believe that the people in those states have rights that they can exercise. Just like the Second Amendment, the guns themselves don't have rights, but people have rights to own and operate and protect themselves with a firearm.
Yeah, it's still at the end of the day, it's tough for even me then, because you don't get rights from a piece of paper.
Agreed. Rights are natural. They're just because we're here.
Right. You don't get rights because government doesn't grant anyone rights. Like they created the Constitution and they put down on paper what they believed to be self-evident, what they believed to be at the time divinely inspired. this is an issue of, if I was Nevada, why would you ever join the union, especially post-Civil War? It makes no sense at all, in my opinion, other than...
Well, it's a one-sided contract.
Yeah, either the government is the Constitution's a contract, but clearly it's not. It's been decided. So if it's not a contract, what is it? It's Andrew Jackson and the Trail of Tears. It is the march of government over lands where people existed in absolute control and force, where you have absolutely no opportunity to do anything other than hop on board. Or we'll put you in a nice little fenced-in area and declare yourself sovereign and toss a few casinos your way.
And you also have to consider, you know, the Monroe Doctrine, that America was what it was from sea to shining sea, regardless of who inhabited or may have owned, in the case of the French, for part of that time. You know, who really is America, and what is it made up of, and what are these people entitled to?
Absolutely. And I think, though,
what do you mean, these people?
I mean, these people, Americans, Chris. Nothing you would know about. You
great right there.
White menace of the North.
Oh, boy.
It's always color with you.
You know, that's funny. I feel like race is such a big deal in the United States. Have you ever even seen a tan Canadian?
Not once.
I'm pretty sure that they're like diversity officers of their corporations are like, what are you talking about? We have all different shades of white.
Listen, people, I've been gone for a while, so maybe it's time that we have a discussion about Canada. 98% of Canadians live on the American border. They've been sending in their drones repeatedly. I have at least 3 Canadian geese outside of my balcony right now listening to this conversation, quacking it back to the motherland. They've sent in their scouts, Michael J. Fox, Alan Thicke.
Bieber.
Justin Bieber. They are watching us. They are ready to invade. It is time to gather together and fight the great white menace of the North.
Build a wall.
That's right. Out of Canadians and beavers.
And maple syrup. So all of a sudden this is Sparta?
That's right.
That's right.
These bastards must be dealt with.
They have to be dealt with because they're trying to come here.
What greater cover for Chris to take?
Have you ever had Canadian food? I don't think so.
Doesn't exist. It's an illusion.
So back to your discussion about the Constitution. I'm going back to Instagram.
No, I mean, all it is it comes back to compact theory. Like, if Clive Nerd. Owen, from a libertarian perspective, Clive Owen is a great actor. But Clive Bundy is not a great actor. But it comes back to, if his family was there, blah, 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 and Lysander Spooner, they didn't sign the contract, they didn't want to be a part of the state of Nevada, they didn't want to join the union, then they're in fact in control of the lands that they claim to own. Unfortunately, they're up against a force they're never going to win against. Is it worth dying for so that your cattle can eat off this grass?
Well, and to be fair, the militia aren't exactly heroes there. They strategically placed women to be in front of them so that if they were fired upon, they were going to have defenseless, unarmed women be the first ones to be taken down. That does not sound very brave. It is certainly not chivalrous,
no,
as those of us from the South can attest.
Can we talk about the nuts for a minute? Because, you know, the Bundy thing is just sort of this canary in the coal mine in some ways. And I know that the people who are itching for a fight with the federal government, meaning, you know, bring on Ruby Ridge and Waco and all that. Like, what is the mentality of that? Like, I just don't understand why you are itching for a gunfight with the federal government. It just doesn't. It makes no sense to me. By the way, Cornelius, the newest addition to the We Are Libertarians family. Sadly, Muffins will no longer be joining us here in the program. She's, I'm sure, doing fine. So Mittens has a new sister, Cornelius, and she is now being petted by Greg. Oh, getting a little frisky there, Greg. Good job. So that is your cat update for this episode of We're Libertarians. So what do you guys think the psychology of that is? Because I just frankly don't get it. I would never go out and stand there with a gun and wait for the firing to start. Like, what is that about? Explain that to me, Brett. You're from God's country.
Well, you know...
Where you have more guns than teeth.
Actually, no. The count is definitely in the reverse there. You know, I can't really speak to it because I'm, like you, not somebody who's itching for that fight. I mean, there are times where when I'm pushed, then yeah, I'm going to push back. There are times when, you know, I feel that rights of mine have been trampled. There are times where I see that rights of others have been trampled, specifically in the case of the government doing so. But I don't understand the people who are willing to join the fight no matter what and no matter who it is. And I think that that really kind of segues into really where we're talking, where we're going, and what we're talking about with regard to Bundy and what happens next when you hitch your wagon to somebody that you don't really know.
Right. Yeah. Greg, what's the psychology of that?
I feel like these individuals, they suffer from a couple things. They suffer from a lack of reality. These individuals, in my opinion, tend to only associate with people who have beliefs like their own and consider anyone else who has a more realistic perspective or a more pragmatic perspective to be a Kool-Aid drinker. They tend to feel like they've been victimized by the majority.
Right.
They tend to feel like they've been ostracized by the... They're really, to me, a whole lot... If you know political philosophy, they're not a whole lot different than people who are Marxists. The ideological superstructure victimizes them. They are victims of the system that is put in place and that they cannot wait to revolt against. And they are... They're a lot like Baptists in that Judgment Day is near.
Right.
But they can make it happen.
You know, you do have to, though, look at it as though... When you mention that, you do have to recognize that the greatest recruiter for the liberty movement and for libertarians is the government. And I'll tell you why. Because when you have an interaction with the Department of Driver Services, or you have an interaction where you're trying to figure out what the heck is going on with your health care, and you tried to go to the ACA website, healthcare.gov, and you just can't get it. You don't understand that those interactions, when you're pulled over by a police officer on an empty road for rolling through a stop sign at 3 o'clock in the morning, when there's nobody around, those are recruitment tools that are turning people into libertarians, and it's the government doing it. So you can't say, though, that everybody that we're talking about hasn't had that moment. They've just had enough of those moments.
No, those individuals aren't alienated. They're not isolated, and they don't go to the chat rooms where they watch Fight Club and talk about the day that it's Judgment Day and this is our time to rule. Right. You know, there is a very, you've talked about it a million times, the anarchist temperament or mindset, that there are a group of individuals who feel that the overthrow is near. They feel like Judgment Day is near, that our currency is bound to collapse, civil society will fall in on itself, we will go back to being self-sufficient, subsistent, one-on-one
soon,
little pontoons.
Soon we'll get into Jeffrey Tuckle's article about brutalism. And he's started a firestorm within the libertarian movement of brutalist versus, what'd you say, humanitarianism?
Humanitarianism, yeah.
Yeah, where, you know, some libertarians want to bring out the best qualities of libertarianism. Jeffrey Tucker's one of those guys, when you hear him talk, you want to live in his world. And then there are people who are brutalist who just dump all of their pathologies onto Facebook and want to, you know, the impulse is towards violence more than making you feel safe and all that. And there is a group called Libertarian Brutalists. If you go to this Facebook group, it is the 4chan of the libertarian movement. It is unbelievable. It is hilarious.
Now I know where I'm going when I leave here.
Greg and I find it hilarious. It's all tongue-in-cheek. I think it was started by Christopher Cantwell.
Yeah.
As sort of a revolt, because now a group of people who do not like to be labeled have been labeled, and so now they're violently fighting back against being called violent.
I'm not brutalist. I petted this cat.
Right.
You know?
So... Yeah. So,
no.
you know, I get it because there certainly are people who just, they wear you out.
But they're martyrs. They're looking right. for their moment to be the hero, to rise to the occasion. They want that spotlight, even though they don't want to talk about it in a deep, dark place. Right. They don't bring up in their chat room on the deep web. But they very much are looking for that opportunity to be the savior of the human race.
So, final thoughts on that before we move on to the man himself, an old white racist.
Brett's here?
I'm only 34, Greg. Not old.
I am kidding, my friend.
All right, so we have this audio clip. So who else was surprised? So Nevada rancher, I'm reading the description from Washington Post here. Cliven Bundy is at the years-long dispute with the BLM. On Saturday, April 19th, he gave a news conference to, like...
You can tell how much dear leader cares right now.
I'm boring myself right now. No, I've just been up since 4 a.m. and it's 9:19 now. I'm tired. So
tell me more about retail politics in Boone County.
Yeah. All right. So Cliven Bundy said the following.
So what I testifying to you, I was in the Lots riot. I seen the beginning fire and I seen that last fire. I seen it, and so what I'm testifying to you, I was in the Lots riot. I seen the beginning fire, and I seen that last fire. What I seen is civil disturbance. People are not happy. People are thinking they don't have their freedoms and don't have these things, and they didn't have them. We've progressed quite a bit from that day until now. And we sure don't want to go back. We sure don't want these colored people to have to go back to that point. We sure don't want these Mexican people to go back to that point. And we can make a difference right now by taking care of some of these bureaucracies and do it in a peaceful way. Let me talk to you about the Mexicans. But these are just things I know about the Negro. I want to tell you one more thing I know about the Negro. When I go through Las Vegas, North Las Vegas, and I would see these little government houses, and in front of that government house, the door was usually open, and the older people and the kids, and there's always at least a half a dozen people sitting on the porch. They didn't have nothing to do. They didn't have nothing for their kids to do. They didn't have nothing for their young girls to do. And because they were basically on government subsidy, and so now what do? They abort their young children. They put their young men in jail because they never learned how to pick cotton. And I've often wondered, are they better off as slaves picking cotton, having family life and doing things? Or are they better off under government subsidy?
They just transferred.
Yeah, they didn't get no more freedom. They got less freedom. They had less family alive and their happiness. You can see in their faces they weren't happy sitting on that concrete sidewalk. Down there they were probably growing their turnips. So that's all government. That's not freedom. Now let me talk about the Spanish people. You know, I understand that they come over here against our Constitution and cross our borders. But they're here, and they're people. And I've worked beside a lot of them. Don't tell me they don't work, and don't tell me they don't pay taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And don't tell me they don't have better family structures than most of us white people. When you see those Mexican families, they're together, they're picnicking together, they're spending their time together, and I'll tell you, in my way of thinking, they're awful nice people. And we need to have those people join us and be with us, not come to our party.
All right, so many of you may have not heard the whole clip, Many of you may have heard that at Thanksgiving from your Uncle Donnie.
it's funny you mention that.
Greg, what are your... let's go to our racist in chief here.
Well, and I mean, I really only... I listened to that clip, and I really only can think one thing, and then that is in retrospect, Brett, do you wish you would have chosen your words more carefully?
You know...
Sorry, buddy. You're new.
You know,
it's horrific.
Dude. You know, I just think they might have been better off slaves. No.
That is never going to work.
What the
what? I sat through this once. I went to see Monticello in Charlottesville, Virginia, and the tour guide got a question from one of the fellow tourists about Thomas Jefferson's owning slaves. And she gave the response, well, it was because the very first slave he bought, he granted his freedom and he went off to New Orleans to be a chef and he ended up starving to death and dying. And so that's why he wouldn't grant freedom to any other slaves he ever had, because he cared about them so much.
Right.
And I was like, oh my God, that you... Oh, people probably won't come here anymore. Like, that was... hugely offensive.
It just, you know, you listen to him and you go, like, there's nothing you can do to fix that guy. He's like this Donald Sterling guy, the Clippers owner, who inexplicably is talking to his 20-something girlfriend, who is half Asian, half black, telling her not to talk to black people and not show off her friends with that she's friends with black people on Instagram, and yet she's half black. Like, the mind of a racist, I guess, we can't figure out. Like, you listen to Clive and Bundy and you go, no, nobody would be better as a slave. Like, there's some people where you're just like, there is no redeeming you whatsoever. Like, there's no coming back from that, buddy.
But Donald Sterling doesn't, the Clippers owner, doesn't strike me as the type of guy that would even ask what nationality that girl was. She right. was... walking by, you know, sure. She was just passing through his life. He doesn't want to hear her life story. If she complains once, there's 15 more ready to jump in her seat.
Right. Yeah. To me, I listen to Clive and Bundy and I go, okay, he's trying to solve the world's problems for those people. So I guess in some way, if we're going to assign some sort of redeeming quality, at least he doesn't want, like, harm to come to anybody. But that's, like, it. Like, you can't... It's just inexplicable to say, like, anybody would be better than... I just don't get it.
Your existence is so miserable that slavery is preferable.
Right. And it's just so ignorant and backwards. It hurts my brain.
I agree. It's backwards. It's cringeworthy. But you know what? If it hadn't been for the recent publicity over his dispute with BLM, he could have lived out the rest of his day spouting those opinions. He could have just been another old white racist rancher in Nevada that nobody cared about.
Right.
But he got his 15 minutes of fame. And often when we see somebody like that who's unprepared for the media onslaught that's going to come about and they're thrust into that limelight, whether it's Clive and Bundy, whether it's Honey Boo Boo,
well, he
whether
held the press
it's Alan West,
though.
But still, he wouldn't have had the opportunity to have a press conference
sure.
if he didn't have the dispute. They aren't prepared for what's... before them, and they're bound to say something stupid or ignorant.
Sure.
And that's what this is. It was stupid, it was ignorant, but it happens. We're all human and we all slip up. Now, one of the things that I think we do need to consider, though, is that we can't dismiss the concept, and I know that this is going to drive a lot of libertarians crazy, but you cannot dismiss the concept of white privilege. You cannot dismiss the concept.
You can leave now.
Of male privilege.
All right.
But that can't be something that's used to shut down a debate. It's being misused, just like I believe that the race card is being overplayed. But at the end of the day, like you mentioned with Uncle Donnie, we all have a crazy uncle who spouts off things like Bundy said.
Like I have family members that are in their late 90s and they say colored because and you just go, listen, she's from a different era.
Sure, and I know a lot of those people.
Right. You know, and there are people in my life who just have crazy. They say crazy racist things.
Joe Ruiz.
Stop it. No. Joe's Puerto Rican. His last name ends at a Z.
It's a cover story.
Right. So, but it is, that's, it just shows why you can't go out and tie yourself to these figures, because they're either going to have something when they come out of nowhere. They're the Sarah Palins of the world, who are the next great Christian hope, and then their daughters are knocked up. You know, it just, nobody leads a perfect life. And
right.
So you've got to tie your movement and your victories to ideas and to tactic and to strategies, and not to people, because people are imperfect.
I think you're exactly right. You know, it's one thing, you see some of the parallels in what Bundy said to some of the things that, say, Walter Williams has said, or that Thomas Sowell has said. And they come at it from being able to say it, because they're a part of an open and honest dialogue about race in this country. But that is something that none of us in this room apparently have a place in modern society to be able to have an open and honest dialogue.
I don't know. Charles Murray, it's like Cliven Bundy was just reading from Charles Murray and doing a very poor translation of it, where Charles Murray is coming at the Watts riots and some of the programs on minority communities. He's coming at it from an academic, scientific studies position, research, whereas Cliven Bundy is coming, you know, I used to see them black people on the porch, and that just means that all black people are like that. It's like, you know, it's a little bit different.
It reminds me of the Phil, the Duck Dynasty thing. Well,
right.
I remember they were happy as can be when we were all in the fields together.
Right.
Oh, wish you would have spoken to a PR agent before you decided to do that.
Right. And again, it goes back to what I said. There are people
in defense of Phil Robertson, he was talking about his personal experience, the people that he came in personal contact with. He was not saying that the experience of all this race was this in this time period. He was saying the people that were as poor as I was, but of a different color in that time period, were this. Now, he was intimating that that maybe the whole racism thing was overblown.
They had it figured out.
Right. You know, whereas Cliven Bundy's saying, like, listen, they all just need to get a jab. It's like, oh, boy.
I'll tell you, though, this is something that's...
He did have nice words for the Spanish people.
But this is something that's been fought for a long time. I don't know if you remember Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan. Do you remember him from New York?
Mm-hmm.
He wrote that controversial Moynihan report, which said that, you know, he had essentially linked the breakdown of African-American nuclear family when measured by, you know, what would you say, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant standards. It was the father not having to be accountable and stay with the family because of the rise of the entitlement state, which led to the breakdown of the African-American nuclear family unit. And that report was met by racism from Al Sharpton. It was met from racism by Jesse Jackson. It was met by everybody. And at the time, he was deputy assistant secretary of the Department of Labor. So he was a no-name. He wasn't a big-name politician. But that plagued him his entire life. His entire life. And all he tried to do was be unafraid of difficult questions.
Yep.
But if you're in the game of politics, double standards exist. The more you fight it, the more you're destined to obscurity.
I mean, there's a couple observations that I've had. Just first is Facebook friends. Libertarians have this weird tendency. Let me do the other one first, because then I think it will explain why libertarians feel the way that they feel about these sorts of issues. You know, I posed the question to Greg, if this guy went out and beat this woman, or if he went out and killed somebody with his car, or even killed somebody with a gun, do you think that he'd be losing the Clippers? Probably not.
Well, take a look at some of the things that don't get you kicked out of the NBA. Apparently, you can choke out your coach.
Right.
And you can punch a fellow player. You can draw guns over gambling debts in the locker room. Or you can fight with fans and only be suspended for 50 games.
Ray Lewis killed a guy, and he's a Hall of Famer.
Lance Stevenson pushed his pregnant girlfriend down the floor, and now he's the starting shooting guard on the Indiana Pacers.
So, I mean, there is, you know, it seems like this is a bit of overkill for the Sterling situation.
Mm.
But at the end of the day, he did, as part of a private organization, which the NBA is, he did agree to the contracts. He did agree as the owner to abide by the bylaws,
sure.
The constitution, whatever it is that the NBA is governed by. He agreed to that, and he knew that there is at some point that he could be held accountable,
sure.
And held to that.
Now, here's my point. We as libertarians believe in the non-aggression principle. So you can say whatever crazy crap you want. You can believe whatever crazy crap you want. As long as you're not forcing your opinion on others, if you're Clive and Bundy and you think that slavery is okay or that people would be better off in slavery, say that all you want. But the second that you try to force someone into slavery, that is a different story because you are physically harming another person, if you're hitting another person, if you're murdering a person, if you're assaulting...
How about a mile-wide fire from Chattanooga to Savannah?
Listen, that's different, okay? Not joking. So, if you lie, if you fraud, if you commit fraud in a business dealing, if you steal from someone, you are taking their property or you are harming their physical person... Libertarians find that to be offensive. I find human trafficking and sex slavery to be way more of an issue that we ought to be discussing and that we should be disgusted by. Like I applaud President Obama for shining a light using celebrities, whatever means he has necessary, on sexual assault, because that's the kind of stuff that we ought to be talking about, that we ought to be shaming people for. James Winston, this quarterback, he raped a girl. It didn't get investigated whatsoever, but now he's in trouble for stealing crab legs.
Allegedly raped a girl.
Allegedly, whatever. This is my podcast. He raped a girl.
What a racist to assume that a young black quarterback raped a girl without giving him allegedly.
Whatever.
Interesting. Canada changed you, my friend.
Yeah, I'm just saying, it never got... Now to these stolen crab legs, apparently he's this great felon. I mean, he didn't get shamed whatsoever. He's going to go to the NFL. He won the Heisman Trophy after all of this stuff allegedly surfaced. I mean, it just blows my mind that an opinion that is countercultural is what really bunches our panties up. So I see that in that point being made on social media by libertarians, and they do it poorly, so it comes across like they're supporting this Sterling guy, when really what they're trying to say is, like, this is not something we should be outraged by morally because he's not physically hurting, he's not stealing, he's not defrauding.
Well, hang on. You go back to some of the settlements that he had before the comment where actively preventing people from having affordable housing because of their race.
But
where he's actively pushing them away.
We just wandered our way into libertarian Never Never Land.
Let's avoid this like
this
the plague.
This is not where you want to
wade
this conversation
into.
What have
you done? You've come on the podcast.
And now
and you've ruined it.
You went where you are not supposed to go, when is a psychological state of terror force and when is it not?
We're talking about property rights and how it's the foundation, and then you say it. Anyways,
it doesn't matter because Donald Sterling is a servant of the market.
Sure.
The Los Angeles Agreed. Clippers are only able to stay in business as long as he can be the owner and functionally provide for the organization that mm-hmm. he wants to support. Is the NBA forcing a decision on him? Yes, but he agreed to the bylaws.
Exactly.
Regardless, the market would have forced this onto the Clippers. In
sure,
time,
you see their sponsors.
A black guy would not have been willing to play for them.
Mm-hmm. Doc Rivers said that after the season, he wasn't likely to stick around as the head coach.
Doc Rivers is
vice president of basketball operations.
Yep.
He's a fantastic coach. Chris Paul, Blake, what's his face? Blake Griffin.
Why does the Native American always get forgotten?
They have several fantastic players. You know, for the first time in their history, they're not an absolute disaster of a team. They've been atrocious most of their history. Now they're doing well. They're putting butts in the seats. Celebrities are starting to show up to their games and not the Lakers. And this guy with his insane beliefs has threatened all of that. And so guess what? You lose Chris Paul, you lose Blake Griffin, you lose Doc Rivers, you go back to being a crappy team, and then your franchises move to Denver or where, you know, Seattle, you know, who lost the Supersonics. So, you know, the market corrects itself. I mean, it's, you know, the organization's going to correct itself in the NBA.
And that's the thing, is I felt like the NBA reacted before it needed to. Adam Silver felt a need, and this is sort of, it's not politically oriented, but Adam Silver has been essentially deputy to David Stern for many, 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 many years within the NBA. He wanted to establish himself as a name and not just, oh, that's Stern's minion. And this was his chance to come down like Thor.
Well, yeah, he wanted his Kennesaw Mountain Landis moment.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep. So, all right, well, we got to wrap up because I have to go to bed. I have to be up at 4 in the morning, and it's now 9:45. Okay, and this has been almost a two-hour episode, so you people are getting your money's worth tonight, all right?
What do you mean, you people?
I mean, you swarthy people. You two, listen, I'm a strawberry blonde white man with blue eyes. You two, little swarthy, just saying. All right.
I don't even know what swarthy means.
He called me Murphy at the Young Americans for Liberty event.
Murphy?
You called me, when I walked in, you called me Murphy at that y'all event.
You are Murphy.
I don't even know what Murphy means. Does that mean like John Murtha?
No, you carry a lot corrupt? Of, you carry a lot of mirth.
Huh.
You're a mirthy person.
This sounds very like wouldn't the three wise men.
Wouldn't you say he's mirthy?
I think you're just making words up.
Swarthy is a legitimate word. It means that you're dark complected.
Oh.
It's not a racially sensitive word necessarily, but
yeah, Chris.
So
of course it is the palest person in the room calling everybody else swarthy.
Listen,
white guilt.
I'm the president of all libertarians. I will oppress you. All right. So Brett, you are unfamiliar with the customs of this podcast. So at the very end, we give you.
What are you talking about? I listen to every single episode.
Stop lying to the audience and stop lying to me with your white privilege or sort of white privilege. So
don't make me go Sherman on you, bro.
Right. I will come burn down your carrot patch. So at the end of the episode, we like to give you the opportunity. I don't know what a carrot patch is either.
I was going to say, is he ginger? And I just don't know it.
You get to say whatever you'd like. You get to get up on your soapbox and rant about something that maybe we missed that you prepared, something that you'd like to self-promote. Whatever you'd like to talk about, this is your time to shine. If you'd like Greg to go first,
that would
you
be
may.
Great.
All right. So, Gregory, give us your take.
I'm a little disappointed because the one thing that I was so prepared to talk about and so excited to talk about, but that's okay, we can do it on another show, is this new book called Capital in the 21st Century. It is an update on Marx. You're going to remember when this book was published, it will be as influential as Lord John Maynard Keynes' general theory that allowed governments for the first time in history to overspend because it pays for itself. This book gives license, and this isn't just within a country. This is on a global scale for the IMF, for the World Bank, for global governments to come together and start to levy wealth taxes because they're in such bad shape financially. This book grants them that license. It has been heaped with praise that it does not deserve by the likes of Paul Krugman, by the likes of former international bankers like Tim Geithner. It is absolute hogwash.
Right. It's written by a Frenchman, people.
Yes.
And it was criticized in France for not being left enough.
Exactly. And if there is, I will only take advice from a Frenchman on one thing, and that is how to surrender. And
listen,
that's it.
They make a nice croissant.
No. Belgium does it better.
All right. All right.
But I'm just saying, like, this is a book, and this is not being talked about a ton. The Economist has picked up on it, Business Insider, a few things, and it is. He uses academic frameworks and blah, blah, blah. He doesn't view the world like an Austrian. But this is the kind of book, and it's got the kind of critical praise that goes down as a tipping point for governments to keep themselves self-sustaining by global taxation for the first time in history. So that's what I would watch out for. The other thing is Hannah Drozich will be on next week. I am not a scumbag Republican, but she is in fact a scumbag Republican.
She is a scumbaggy Republican, and we're going to Talk a little 2016 action. Gary Johnson's back in the mix. He's going to run again.
And if she has any guts at all, she'll wear her Romney shirt, and I'll make fun of her for it.
Right. She is a Marco Rubio fan.
But remember, did you ever read that comment that I wrote?
No.
Rubio 2016, conservatism with a kick. Somebody call Karl Rove.
Did you spell conservatism with a K? Good.
Of all the actors running for president, Marco Rubio is the most Spanish.
That was brilliant. And she did not appreciate it.
No, she didn't. All right, so your turn.
All right, I'm going to plug myself. If you're interested in any of the things that I've said about being a better libertarian, check out brettbittner.com. That's BRETTBITTNER.com. You can also find me on Facebook at facebook.com/thekindlibertarian. If you have yet to take the world's smallest political quiz, go to theadvocates.org.
Why did you invite
quiz.
Me to like that?
Or you could go and follow them on Facebook at facebook.com/itookthequiz so that you can share your score. You can share your experience either giving or taking the quiz. Share your pictures. Share your stories of outreach. It's something new that I'm bringing out for people to have a community around the quiz and kind of personify it a bit. At the end of the day, can we all just love each other? Mm-hmm. Like, seriously, guys.
All right. So my soapbox, I would like you to go like my Facebook page, The Angry Libertarian. Go to I Didn't Take the Quiz /Facebook.com. And I would like you to take the world's longest political quiz.
Just show of hands.
Oh, are you talking about the Libertarian Purity Test?
Yeah.
The bpkaplan.org or whatever?
Yeah. There is one of those. And that is, if you see it on social media and you don't take the quiz after clicking on it to look at the quiz, then you are the purest of the pure, because you will not be told what to do. However,
that is brilliant.
You know, I mean, it's the ultimate litmus test. Also, the We Are Libertarians Liberty.me guide. We are published Liberty.me people here.
That's
in a couple
right.
weeks.
All right, everybody. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your patience during this difficult time since Greg left me. We greatly appreciate it. We love you. We're going to be back on a regular schedule. We're not going to be lazy, meaning me.
Speak for yourself.
And Brett, we look forward to never having you back.
Excellent.
All right. No, thank you seriously
thank
for making
you, Brett.
The drive down. Coming on. We greatly appreciate it. We thank you all for listening. This has been an episode of We Are Libertarians. And as always, we promise
to do better next time.
Music for We Are Libertarians is provided by Hoosier musician Brian Keith Wallen. Please check out his website, briankeithwallen.com. The song is Bad Spell.